I'm sorry about that. My name is Chris Ribbons, and I am with TEDx, the Endocrine Disruption Exchange. I would like to welcome you to today's call, which is titled Toxicology of Fracturing Flowback Fluid, Potential Endocrine Disruptor. Our moderator today will be Kim Schultz, TEDx's Oil and Gas Research Coordinator. Our speaker has provided slides to accompany his presentation, and the link to download them was emailed to everyone who registered for the call. If you still need to download the slides, you can do so now from our website at tedx.org. On the homepage, click on the link in the What's New box on the right-hand side, which says Teleconference Calls on Oil and Gas. This will take you to our Videos and Webinars page. Click on the first call with today's date, and this will take you to the call page. Once on the call page, you can click on the link to download the slides. This call is scheduled for 30 minutes, with time at the end of the call for questions. Due to the high number of participants on the call, if you have a question or comment, we ask that you post these to our live chat. You can access the live chat by going to the call page and clicking on the link provided. We will be monitoring all of the comments and questions throughout the call, and we'll read questions to the speaker after his presentation. Right now, everyone has been muted with the exception of our moderator and our speaker. As I noted, the call will last 30 minutes, and it is being recorded. With that, I'm going to hand things over to you, Kim.
Thank you so much, Chris. I'd like to welcome everyone to our call. I'm excited to expand our health focus today to include aquatic species with our presenter, Dr. Greg Goss. Dr. Goss is a professor in biological sciences at the University of Alberta with a cross appointment to the School of Public Health and a fellow of the National Institute of Nanotechnology. He is the past scientific director of the University of Alberta Water Initiative and director of the Office of Environmental Nanosafety. His broad water toxicology research program uses both fish and invertebrates, in vitro and in vivo techniques, and whole animal to molecular approaches to investigate the effects of a number of contaminants, including hydraulic fracturing fluids. He is working directly with Environment Canada, the OECD, and other government agencies to provide direct evidence for devising appropriate guidelines for risk assessment and standardized testing. So thank you so much, Dr. Goss, for sharing your research with us, and I will turn it over to you.
Okay, thank you very much. I appreciate the opportunity to give this talk. It's a little bit of a different format for me to give a telephone talk, but we'll manage our way through it. And thank you to everybody for joining, whether it's good morning or good afternoon, depending on where you are. I'm just going to give an overview of some of the work that we've been fortunate enough to be able to conduct on hydraulic fracturing and flowback fluid, working with a company to be able to investigate the potential toxicity of those particular fluids in a variety of different mechanisms and methods. So to get started, the first slide simply has my information. If needed, anybody can contact me afterwards. That information is available, and I'll certainly try to respond as much as possible, giving time constraints, depending on the questions. But hopefully that's available to everybody. So to go to the second slide, I think most people here are fairly familiar with hydraulic fracturing. And for those of you who might not be, I've just had a quick slide. In the Canadian context, we don't do much shallow hydraulic fracturing. Our shales are quite deep, up to 4 kilometers, and this will deal specifically with the Canadian context. But the operations are still the same. It's the mixture of water proppants and chemical additives that we know are presented and injected into the ground and used to fracture at high pressures. And these chemical additives include a number of things that are biocides and surfactants. And so we obviously expect toxicity. This is not honey water. It is an industrial effluent. But the question is, what are the risks associated with both the materials on site, so to workers, for example, or to the environment with regards to spills, overland spills that might occur as part of the operations? And so Well, before I get started, I'm going to just change some of the terminology. We in our lab have decided to use a combination of the term flowback and produced waters. I think we know that oil wells have been producing what's called produced water, and this is going for direct disposal for a long time. And the distinction really between terms flowback and produced water are really operational, often associated with either a time in some jurisdictions, say 7 days or 14 days of operation from opening the well, or sometimes associated with a crew change from the different people that are on site. And so we combine the two because if you have produced water which still has residual chemicals that from the hydraulic fracturing process and you can determine that, then really that's still part of the flowback from us, and so that's the reason for that particular term. Of course, the concentrations of different things in the FPW and the flowback and produced water varies by time of flowback. Obviously, earlier would have more of the anthropogenic or man-derived chemicals, and the later would have mostly formation waters, and those formation waters are standard industrial effluents we've been dealing with for a long time. There's both inorganic and petrogenic components, some things coming from the oils themselves and from the shales that are directly in the formation. So different formations are going to have different metals or salts that are bred up. And then the third part I think that I will address is that there's a potential for what we call downhole reaction products. In other words, when we mix these chemicals, we have high heat and high temperature, and we might have extended periods of time. We may end up with reaction products on downhole, and we'll try and give at least our first iteration that some of these are actually forming. And so the chemical compositions are going to be held by trade secrets, by practitioners, and so getting that information of what went down the hole is really an issue for us, but we can certainly detect stuff that is in the flowback and produced water. So on to the next slide, which is slide 4. You can see that what I'm going to talk about is there's an arrow on the white slide suggesting the area of FPW acquisition. This is called the Fox Creek area of the Duvernay Formation in Alberta. It's a fairly deep shale, very warm because it's on the eastern slope, so it's 90 to 100 degrees centigrade down where they're fracturing. And in this region, we can have between 10 and 100 million liters of fracturing fluid and water pumped down per well. There's a variety of different amounts, but we have fairly high volume wells, and they're fairly deep. And depending on the well, between 10 and 80% of that comes back as flowback. And so this is just the wells and the cumulative wells that were done in this region over the 2.5 year period of a study that we published in the Canadian Water Resources Journal last fall. And this is just an idea of sort of the extent of the operations here in Canada. And I'm sure they're similar in many of the places in the U.S. On to the next slide, slide 5. One of the things that, in terms of risk for the population and, more importantly, risk for the environment is we know that there's been numerous large and small spills of FPW either on-site or directly into other areas and sometimes environmentally sensitive areas. The picture that you have there is a picture from a burst pipeline that occurred in 2013 in Alberta called Zama City, way up in the north, when approximately 9.5 million liters of FPW spilled into a marshland. And of course, this caused some severe environmental damage. There are numerous other documented cases, including those in in North Dakota and in the Marcellus shales as well in eastern North America and Barnett in Texas, where we see numerous other spills. So we know that these are occurring. And the question really from us is, and from our industrial partners, is one, how do we make sure that we've mitigated those? And two, how do we make sure that we have a documented method to ensure that they've been cleaned up properly? And is there any long-term potential risk to the populations? So a number of years ago, in working with an industrial partner, so we're fortunate enough to have a very progressive company called Encana Corporation here in Canada, who wanted to look at the hazard assessment for their materials. And so we have an industrial partner relative grant with through our Natural Sciences and Engineering Research Council of Canada through what's called a Collaborative Research and Development Program. This is a five-year study. We're in year two right now. And the PI of that is somebody named Dan Alessi and John Martin and myself, so the tripartite mechanism. And the inorganic chemistry and microbiology components done by Dan Alessi, John Martin has been, and his lab have been doing the organic chemistry and identification of components, and I've been in charge of doing the toxicology. So we have a very large program that functions to do all these different components. On the next slide, so slide seven, so we've been provided with a number of samples over the last couple of years, year and a half, with of FPW, and so some at the beginning were single samples, and we now, but we haven't, I'm not going to report on these right now, have time-derived samples where we look over the time of the flowback, so that's the next stages. But this is an example on the right side with the orange-looking liquid is the base flowback in produced water. The reason it's orange is it has a lot of iron oxides that have formed as a result of oxidation. From dissolved iron that's come up from the formation. These form a variety of sediments over time. We have mixtures of polymer and a variety of other components that are present. These samples are around day six, I believe, of a flowback. And so we've treated them in two different ways. One where we've done a filtration of them. So we do a sediment-free. We filtered through a 0.2 micron filter to remove all the minor sediment. And so we've tested the sediment and the sediment-free, and then we also have an activated carbon filtered, which when we measure by our analysis shows to have almost no organics and metals remaining, but still has all the salts. So this is a control to make sure that we're not mixing up the effects of salt and the toxicology of salt with the effects of the organics and inorganics present in the FPW. So going on to the next slide, this is just a chemical characterization so you can put it in context. The formation that we have in Canada, in the Fox Creek Formation, happens to be at the edge of a very large ancient saline lake. It's down into the Paskapoo Formation. And so this particular area has very high salinity. If you look at the total dissolved solids in the parameters in the blue, the top one where we method by evaporation, you see that a liter of the flowback fluid that we present has essentially 242,000 or 242 grams or 242,000 milligrams per liter, so extremely salty. To put that into perspective, the salinity of seawater is 33,000, so this would be about a brine that would be about the same as seven times the amount of seawater. So extremely salty, and the salt itself is also damaging to the environment. So we have to be able to understand and separate and segregate those saline effects from the actual effects of the organics or inorganics. There's another couple of other products that are in there. This is all reported in the recent water research paper we published, and the reference is listed at the end of the talk. And so just importantly, note that most of it is dominated by sodium and chloride with a number of other ions being present. And we do document some of the minor components that are part of the methods, the mechanisms of salts and heavy metals and that as well in that paper. So moving down to the next slide, what we've done here, and this is reported again in the water research paper that we published, we have the sediment fraction of the FPW. So remember that orange-looking liquid. When we separate the sediment from the component, one of the interesting things that we found was we found in that sediment a number of spherical structures of around 1,000 micrometers or 1,000 nanometers or 1 micrometer. So very small spheres. These are hollow spheres. Which, again, were not necessarily reported in any of the databases, but we believe that these are one of the proprietary products that are put down. and to contain a breaker called ammonium persulfate, which allows, when you have gel-based fracs, to dissolve and reduce the viscosity and allow better flow. So it has ammonium persulfate, which is a very high oxidizer. So it provides a very high oxidative potential when you need it to be able to do this. And so we have a variety of different compounds that are put down. And this is just an example of some of the research that we're trying to identify some of the components that are up there. And these are small hollow shell wall, thin shell walls, and we've been able to isolate and examine those. And those are discussed, as I mentioned, in the paper that we published in Water Research. Moving down to slide 10, before we get to the toxicology, it's important to do our characterizations and tell you a little bit about some of these things. So on the very top graph, this is an organic analysis of the particular sample, this sample that we studied, in which we, if you look at the very top graph, it looks kind of like a variety of spikes coming out of the three-dimensional graph. And each of those spikes represents a particular compound that's present in the FPW. And there's a numerous very small and large spikes, so the relative amounts are approximately represented by that, but not quantitatively, because there's differences in sensitivity of detection. In panel B, you can see actually the what's called a Kendrick plot, those blue dots. And those blue dots simply look at the mass of the particles versus your detection. And so the each blue dot represents a different chemical species that we found. Many of these, of course, are going to be the organics that are present in the sample. They're not just what's been put down. They're going to be the stuff that's coming up from the formation, so all the oil and oil-related contaminants. And being able to understand and separate those and see if those are different from other just standard oil wells is part of our process. But this is an untargeted, where we just say what is there, and then we can start to do secondary analysis. So part C is an example of that secondary analysis. If you see the very large spike there, the very large peak that's represented right at the very end of the runtime of the column, at the end you see that large spike, and going down into panel C, this is actually the related compounds that are associated with that spike. So peak 5 is the large peak, and then if you see, there's also peaks 1, 2, 3, and 4. Those are related compounds which have the same chemical structure that come off at also different times. So you might have one compound, and then as it breaks down, or if it's produced and has different compounds, it may have some products that are part of that. So we did what's called MS-MS analysis on those particular compounds, and if you go to the next slide, slide 11, this is an example of what we think are the possible formation of downhole reaction products and some of their implications for our study. For example, as I told you before, in this particular formation, we have a fairly high heat. You know, 90 to 100 degrees centigrade is not uncommon down at the 1.8 to 2 kilometers where this well was drilled. It's, of course, under very high pressure, and we have not only the chemicals that we put down, but, formation metals which can serve as catalysts, as a possibility that are down there to form reaction products. So what we've found is actually on the right. So on the right, you see I've put four of the compounds there, 1, 2, 3, and 5, and those are what are called triphenyl phosphates. So the PO4, so four oxygens surrounding the phosphorus, is a phosphate. And those phosphates are a number of different compounds, and perhaps maybe more, but these are the ones we've been able to detect and positively identify in our analysis. So the interesting thing about phosphates, there's very little work research done into toxicology of triphenyl phosphates, the ones with three of the phenyl compounds, so compounds 1 and 5. But compounds 2 and 3 are diphenyl phosphates, which are common flame retardants and known to be potential EDC and endocrine disrupting compounds. So these are ones that we find in the materials. Now, we believe, but again, because we don't have access to the original hydraulic fracturing fluid that went down the well, that this likely represents breakdown products or transformation products. So they could either be breaking down from the original compound, or the compound that's made may have different compositions of these original compounds. And this is from a phosphite. So if you look on the left-hand compound, the Ergophos 168, is the what we believe to be the parent phosphate compound. This is a tert butylphenyl phosphite, right? So the PO only has three oxygens around it. It's very water insoluble for the most part. It's considered an antioxidant chemical stabilizer used to be able to adjust and to maintain an antioxidant compound for a long time, which is what you would want going down the hole. It's considered to be non-toxic by all the LC50s. It has a very high concentration, so it would not be considered a risk under normal environmental circumstances due to its both low solubility and its low toxicity. But upon transformation in a highly oxidative environment, it likely is converting. Now, I must add that we don't know for sure that this is the chemical in the original fluids. And we don't know if the generation of these compounds directly came from Ergophos, but the suspicion is that because of the parent compound and the similarity, that they're likely to be related. And that is something that we still have to investigate. So going forward now to slide 12, right, which we'll get into the toxicology. And the toxicology is we have common ecotoxicological models that are used for risk assessment. And if you go to slide 13, you see that what we've done in the first one is to look at rainbow trout. Now, rainbow trout are a common model used for hazard assessment. And we've tested both sediment and sediment-free. So we wanted to see what was in the sediment and if it's different from the separation. So moving along into slide 14, what I want to point out is when you have exposure to hydrocarbons, enzymes in your cells, specifically in the gills and the liver, tend to turn those planar hydrocarbons into transformation products, which allow us to excrete it. So it's a part of our normal physiological biological process. And when you're exposed, these enzymes tend to go up in activity, and it's a good indicator that you've been exposed, so a good positive control. And we've exposed the fish at either sediment-free at 2.5% or 7.5% of the original concentration, or the sediment-containing, so the two different solutions, or the activated charcoal treated, which has none of the hydrocarbons or very few of the hydrocarbons left. And you can see specifically, if you look at the rightmost graph on slide 14, that the sediment-containing materials, so the not the very outside bars, but the next two in, the sediment at 2.5% and 7.5% show a 5 to 10% tenfold increase. And it's clear that the sediment-free has less effect than the sediment-containing. So the sediment appears to carry much of the toxicity or much of the oil compounds. And similarly, because we also talked about those peroxide breakers and the potential for them to be having a high oxidative potential, if you look on slide 15 now, we found that the FPW itself, so in the absence of any animal, if we just measure its ability to make oxidative stress, the sediment-free and sediment-containing materials, the bars in the middle of slide 15, have a fairly high oxidative potential. In other words, they can induce oxidative stress. On the right side of that is the effect on the fishes themselves. So on the right side, you see the relative fold change in T-bars, which is an indicator of oxidation of our lipids or our cell membranes. And so if you look at the liver, the gill, and the kidney as three tissues, you could see that the oxidative stress is increasing, whether we talk about working with 2.5%, it goes higher in the sediment-free at 7.5%, but the sediment-containing at 2.5% is much higher than the sediment free at 2.5%. So there's an increasing oxidative potential, and this is expressed in all the different tissues. So it's clear that these tissues present a possibility for oxidative stress, and this is expected, I think, for hydrocarbon-containing materials. Probably more importantly for this talk is in rainbow trout, I'm not going to go through the enzymes that are present in slide 16 on the relative mRNA abundance for biotransformation or oxidative stress because they're very small changes to begin with. But if you look at the rightmost five bars, you can see that the telogenin, VTG, right, is a yolk protein found that is responsive gene responsive to endocrine disrupting compounds. And you can see that the expression of vitellogenin and the control is set at 1, but in sediment containing at 2.5%, it's a 8 to 9-fold increase. And if we go to 7.5%, we have an 18 to 20-fold increase in that gene. So that suggests that the receptors for vitellogenin are somehow turning on and we're getting induced endocrine disrupting compounds. Importantly, we have the VTG being turned on, but we and also the estrogen receptor A2, but not estrogen receptor A1 or estrogen receptor B1 or B2. So it's a very specific response, likely associated with a very specific chemical mixture. Right now, this is an expression of the gene itself, but not necessarily related to the protein or the actual endocrine disruptor. So this is something that we have to further investigate, and we have experiments ongoing at this time right now to look for the biological effect of long-term exposure. Similarly, not only are rainbow trout an issue, but if we look at zebrafish embryos, so we can look at developmental toxicity, you see that similarly to the with this zebrafish embryo, if you look on the bottom of the mortality, the right or the sort of the leftmost curves are those associated with the sediment-containing materials or at the 1 to 96 hours. You see that in embryos, it's less than 1%, so 0.6%. causes 50% mortality in zebrafish embryos, and the sediment-free versus activated carbon, which is the salt-based effect. Importantly, if we expose them for the first 24 hours, there is a strong organic toxicity, but after 24 hours, if we start from 24 hours onward, the salt dominates the toxicity, and we can't differentiate between the two. So it's a clear early-stage developmental effect of the organics, but not necessarily, we can't say much about after 24 hours. And so what we wanted to do is say, how can we deal with the fact that we have salt, and we want to look at the organics? So what we've done is this next series of experiments is that we have taken the organics and extracted them out and applied just the organics without the salt onto the zebrafish embryos, and then now assess their developmental toxicity of just the organic component itself. So just briefly, on slide 19, we can say a couple of things. We've taken two different samples from another thing, and we've extracted only the organics. So clearly, for the next couple of slides, there'll be a few things that I'm going to talk about. The first is we have 1W, that means sample 1, the water fraction, right? Sample 1S is sample 1 and just the sediment fraction, so the organics associated with the sediment. And then P is where we pooled those two together as if we made the sample again. So we have two different samples here, sample 1 and sample 2. We have water fractions, we have sediment fractions, and we have a pooled fraction. So it just gives you an idea going forward of what this means. When we apply or we do the chemical analysis of the priority pollutants under the US EPA, and on the next slide, slide 20, you see that the concentration of different components in different samples, there are two things to notice. The FPW sample 1 has only 10% of the concentration of organics that FPW sample 2 has, so there's quite a big variety in those. And the second thing to notice in the, both the water and the sediment fraction, and the second thing to notice is if you look at the sediment fraction, it contains the very high molecular weight organics, and the water fraction has the low molecular weight and polar organics, suggesting, which is what you would expect. So the it's not always the same organics associated with each fraction. And this is just for the priority pollutants and PAHs that we can detect. When we look at the toxicity of these fractions, they clearly develop, have some toxicity in the zebrafish embryo. And we find that sample 2 with the higher organic concentration has a higher toxicity compared to sample 1. So sample, the numbers on the LC50 suggest that we have a, the pooled fraction is always more toxic than individual fractions by themselves, but sample 2 is much less, much more toxic than sample 1. Hello?
Dr. Goss?
Yep.
I'm so sorry to interrupt you, but I know some people are going to have to go now that it is 30 minutes after the hour.
Yeah.
And would you mind just trying to wrap it up a little bit
faster? Yeah, I will. Sorry. I was paying attention to the time. I didn't realize we didn't get started for a few minutes, but I'll try and get through just very briefly. So we tested things like spinal malformation and showed that the spinal malformation is much greater in the sample 2 than sample 1. And these are standard issues for pericardial edema. Is another indicator of oil and gas exposure. And what I think for the endocrine disruption, we've also looked at the transcriptional responses, and we see the same thing as we saw before, in which we have the upregulation of those biotransformation enzymes. This is on slide 24. And the same upregulation as we saw before with those oxidative stresses. So the materials and the stresses are, and those stresses that we saw before are in fact carried by the organic fraction. But importantly for this EDC talk, is the endocrine disruption that's shown in slide 26, which is a real key one. We see that the we get responses from the organic fraction for estrogen receptor 1A, and 2B, and androgen receptor, and vitellogenin. But interestingly, we have differences between sample 1 and sample 2. So not all FPWs are created equal with respect to causing organic or endocrine disrupting effects. Some have different effects than the others, and there's obviously an important consideration that we have to say. We can't lump them all together and say there's always an endocrine disrupting effect in all samples. And I'm going to just briefly go through the daphnia to summarize for you. I'm not going to talk. So because daphnia showed the exact same effect. These are water fleas, except they were very, very sensitive. At 0.04%, we saw significant effects on reproduction in daphnia. And so what we think we have now is apparent transformation products. We show that sediment fraction is the greatest toxicity compared to the water-accommodated fraction. And we think that there's likely to be these three effects coincident with FPW exposure: biotransformation, oxidation and metabolic impairment, and endocrine disruption. But because we don't have the specific components yet, we cannot yet attribute to a particular component, but we are trying to do that. Summing up, we'll talk. I'll just give my acknowledgments because this doesn't get done without some tremendous work by a number of people. We have many, many researchers involved. I'll mention the ones from my lab, specifically Tamsin Blewett, Henry He, Eric Folkerts, Perrine Delompre, Alyssa Weinrau, Matt Barker, and Joy Lee. And my information is on slide 31. And with that, I will take any questions. Sorry for being a few minutes over.
No, thank you so much for sharing that with us. And I look forward to hearing more about your future research because you guys are producing a lot of research, and I know we can stay tuned for a lot of new articles from you.
Well, like I said, I think we're fortunate enough to have a great industrial partner who's believed in us that we can do an independent study that looks at the toxicology, because our intent is to feed back to them what is the environmental and occupational health and safety effects that they have to worry about, and how do they manage those properly. And they've been a great company. They don't have any input directly into the studies we do. The only thing that they do get from us is advance notification of the publications by a few weeks so that they have an opportunity to prepare. But other than that, they really have no input into our studies, and I should make that apparent.
Oh, well, we do have, okay. I'm not sure that we can take any questions right now because we do have to wrap it up. I'm so sorry. If people want to submit a question, we can get them to you, and perhaps you could answer them.
Yeah, I could answer them. So my email address is on the presentation, greg.goss@umurder.ca, and I or one of my members of my team will be able to answer most of your questions, I hope, maybe not some. There'll be ones that are specific. We know that there's lots of questions on toxicology, and I should note that these are, to my knowledge, the only papers on the actual toxicology of hydraulic fracturing fluids. So we're just at the early stage, but I think that's an exciting time.
Well, okay, I just want to thank you again for presenting, and thanks to everyone on the call for participating in our series on health impacts from unconventional oil and gas production. And please stay tuned for information on upcoming calls. Now back to Chris to close the call.
Thanks, Kim. I want to make sure that everyone knows that there will be an MP3 recording of this call available on our website soon, and we encourage you to share it with others. We will also be hosting more calls in the future, and we'll send out emails to let you know about them. We also have recordings of previous calls on our website, and would encourage you to listen to the recordings if you are not able to join the calls. Again, I would also like to thank Dr. Goss for taking the time to present his research, Kim, our moderator, and thank you to all of the participants for taking the time out of your day to join us. I hope that you all have a wonderful rest of your day.
Thank you. Thank you.